and to get a picture of this guy Benny. He's a professional operative, right? Something like that. You're a lawyer. I'm a stockbroker. We have no idea what we're doing, and we could easily get ourselves in trouble. Yes, we could. Kyle took a small package from a pocket of his bulky black and gold Steelers parka. Take this, he said, keeping it low so that no one could see it. Joey took it and stuffed it into a pocket of his own black and gold Steelers parka. What is it?
It's a video camera.
Doesn't feel like a video camera.
It's a video camera, but not one you're likely to see in a store window.
The Steelers scored on a long pass, the game's first touchdown, and the crowd celebrated for 5 minutes. During the ensuing timeout, Kyle continued,
It's not much larger than an ink pen. It goes in the pocket of either a shirt or a jacket, with a thin wire running to a control switch in your left hand. You can talk to someone face to face and video the conversation without their knowledge.
So I just walk up to Benny, who's probably heavily armed and has several other heavily armed pals nearby, and introduce myself and ask him to smile.
No, there's a better way. But this week you need to practice with it.
Does it have a name?
It's all there in the paperwork, specs, instructions, all that stuff. Just bone up on it this week and learn how to use it. If things go perfectly, you'll have about 3 seconds to video Benny.
And if they don't go perfectly?
I'll rescue you.
Great. A long, nervous swig from the flask. So, Kyle, let's say we get Benny on video. How do you, not me, but you, go about identifying him?
I haven't figured that out.
There's a lot you haven't figured out.
I'll email you Tuesday, tell you I've got tickets, the usual drill. Are you in, Joey, old pal?
I don't know. I think you're crazy, and you're making me crazy.
Come on. You need to have some fun while you can.
Kyle was hard at work in the main library when the firm phone rattled softly at 4 on Thursday afternoon. The email described itself as urgent and commanded the first-year associates to congregate immediately on the 44th floor mezzanine, the largest gathering place at Scully and Pershing. The message meant only one thing. The bar exam results were in. And the fact that Kyle was being summoned meant that he had passed. For weeks, they had labored against the clock and suffered the often unbearable pressure of adjusting to life in the big firm, and added to that misery was the bar exam hanging over them like a dark cloud. It was always there, seldom discussed because the exam was over, and talking about it only made life worse. But it woke them up when they desperately needed sleep. It followed them to the table and could ruin a meal in an instant. The bar exam. What if they flunked the bar exam? The ritual varied from firm to firm, but Scully and Pershing had a rather pleasant way of breaking the news. They gathered the lucky ones together and threw a party. Though it was supposed to be a surprise, by the second week of September, every new associate knew the drill. The cruel part of the festivities was that the unlucky ones were simply not invited. They were left to retreat, to sneak out of the building and go wander the streets for the rest of the day. As Kyle ran up the stairs and raced along the hallways, he searched for his friends. There were high fives, yelps for joy, people running in shoes that were not meant for running. He saw Dale and gave her a hug, and they walked quickly together. Once on the mezzanine, the crowd was already in a raucous mood before Mr. Howard Meeser, the firm's managing partner, stepped to a small podium and said,
Congratulations! Let's have a party! Not another hour can be billed today.
Champagne corks were soon flying. Bartenders were busy, and waiters began passing delicious antipasto. The general feeling was one of euphoria, even giddiness, because the nightmare was over, and they were now lawyers forever. Kyle was enjoying a glass of champagne with Dale and a few others when the conversation shifted to their less fortunate colleagues.
Does anybody see Garwood?
And they began searching the party for Garwood, who was unaccounted for and soon presumed to be on the other list. Tim Reynolds approached them with a nasty smile, a drink in one hand and a printout in the other.
Tabor flunked, he announced proudly. Can you believe it? A Harvard casualty.
Kyle wasn't as pleased. Sure, Tabor was obnoxious and opportunistic, but he was their cube mate, and flunking the bar would kill him.
He wasn't a bad guy.
Word spread. The body count rose. In all, there were 8 failures out of 103, a pass rate of 92%, an excellent number for any class at any firm. Once again, it was clear that they were the brightest stars, and were now destined for even greater things. They got as drunk as possible, then rode home in private sedans arranged by the firm. Kyle had only 2 drinks and walked to Chelsea. Along the way, he called his father with the wonderful news.
Chapter 24. His appointment at noon Friday with Doug Peckham was described as a working lunch to review some discovery, but when Kyle arrived 10 minutes early, the partner said, "Let's celebrate." They left the building and crawled into the back of a Lincoln sedan, one of the innumerable black cars that roam the city and keep the professionals out of the yellow cabs. The firm had a fleet of black cars on call.
"Been to 11 Madison Park?" Doug asked.
"No, I don't get out much these days, Doug, because I'm a first-year associate and I'm either usually too tired to eat or I don't have time, or I simply forget."
"Whining, are we?"
"Of course not."
"Congrats on passing the bar."
"Thank you."
"You'll like this place. Great food, beautiful dining room. Let's have a long lunch with some wine. I know just the client we can stick it to."
Kyle nodded. 2 months in, and he was still uncomfortable with the notion of sticking it to clients. Padding the file, overbilling, racking up expenses. He wanted to ask what exactly the client was about to get stuck for. Just the lunch, which was a certainty, or would the client also get billed for 2 hours of his time and 2 hours of Peckham's? But he didn't ask. The restaurant was in the lobby of the old Metropolitan Life building, with views of Madison Square Park. The decor was contemporary, with high ceilings and wide windows. Doug, of course, claimed to know the chef and the maitre d' and the sommelier, and Kyle was not surprised when they were seated at a choice table looking at the park.
"Let's get your evaluation out of the way," Doug said, snapping a breadstick and sending crumbs across the pristine white tablecloth.
"Evaluation?"
"Yes, it's my job as your supervising partner to evaluate you after the bar results. Obviously, if you'd flunked, we wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have nice things to say. We'd probably be stopping by one of those carts pushed by a street vendor, selecting a greasy kielbasa, taking a walk, and having a bad conversation. But you passed, so I'm going to be nice."
"Thank you."
The waiter presented menus while the water was poured. Doug chomped on a breadstick, more crumbs flying across the table.
"Your billing is above average. In fact, it's very impressive."
"Thanks."
No surprise that any evaluation at Scully and Pershing would begin with how much money one was raking in.
"I've had nothing but positive comments from other partners and senior associates."
"Drinks? Something to start with?" the waiter asked.
"We'll order some wine with lunch," Doug said, almost rudely, and the waiter disappeared.
"At times, though, you seem to lack commitment, as if you're not fully on board. Fair?"
Kyle shook his head and thought about a response. Doug was a no-nonsense type, so why not level with him?
"I live, eat, and sleep at the firm, like every other first-year associate, because that's the business model some guy came up with years ago, the same way medical residents go 20 hours a day to prove their mettle. Thank God we're not treating sick people. I don't know what else I can do to prove my commitment."
"Good point," Doug said, suddenly much more concerned with the menu.
The waiter hovered, waiting.
"You ready?" Doug said. "I'm starving."
Kyle had yet to look at the menu and was still stinging from the criticism of his commitment.
"Sure," he said.
Everything looked delicious. They ordered, the waiter approved, and the sommelier appeared. At some point during the serious wine discussion that followed, Doug mentioned a first bottle and a second bottle. The first was a white burgundy.
"You'll love it," Doug said. "One of my favorites."
"I'm sure."
"Any problems? Complaints?" Doug asked, as if he were clicking off the items on the evaluation checklist.
With perfect timing, Kyle's firm phone vibrated.
"Funny you should mention it," he said as he pulled it from his coat pocket and looked at the email. "It's Carlene Sanborn, looking for a few hours of light lifting in the placid mortgage mess. What shall I tell her?"
"You're having lunch with me."
Kyle typed the email, sent it, then asked,
Can I turn this off?
Of course. The wine was being presented. Doug sampled it and rolled his eyes, and two glasses were poured.
Kyle pressed on. My complaint is this damned phone. It has become my life. When you were an associate 15 years ago, they didn't have cell phones and smartphones and firm phones, and so...
We worked just as hard, Doug interrupted with a wave of dismissal. Stop complaining. Get tough.
With his other hand, he was raising his wine glass to inspect its contents. He finally took a sip, then nodded his approval.
Well, my complaint is this phone.
Okay. Anything else?
Another check mark in another box.
No, just the usual complaints of associate abuse. You've heard them before, and you don't want to hear them now.
You're right, Kyle. I don't want to hear it. Look, as partners, we know what's going on. We're not oblivious. We survived it, and now we reap the rewards. It's a bad business model because everybody's miserable. You think I want to push myself out of bed at 5 every morning so I can spend 12 crazy hours at the office, so at the end of the year we can divide the spoils and be at the top of the rankings?
Last year, Ape's partners averaged $1.4 million.
We were at $1.3 million, and everybody panicked. We gotta cut costs. We gotta bill more. We gotta hire more associates and grind them into the concrete because we're the biggest.
It's crazy. No one ever stops and says,
hey, you know, I can live on $1 million a year and spend more time with my kids or more time at the beach.
No, sir. We gotta be number one. I'll take $1 million a year. You'll get there. Evaluation's over.
One quick question.
Shoot.
There's a cute first-year associate, and I'm growing rather fond of her. How big a deal is it?
Strict prohibition. How cute?
Getting cuter by the day?
Name?
Sorry.
You gonna do it at the office?
Haven't got that far yet. There are plenty of sleeping bags.
Doug took a breath and leaned forward on his elbows.
There's a lot of sex around the place.
Come on, it's an office. You put 5,000 men and women together and it happens. The unwritten rule is this. Don't screw around with the employees. Secretaries, paralegals, support staff, clerks, those who are considered somewhat below us. We call them the non-lawyers. As for your fellow associates, or partners for that matter, no one really cares as long as you don't get caught.
I've heard some great stories.
They're probably true. Careers have been ruined. Last year, two partners, both married to other people, started a hot affair, got caught, and were kicked out. They're still looking for jobs. But for two unmarried associates, come on. Just don't get caught.
The first courses arrived, and sex was forgotten. Kyle had a leek and cheese tart. Doug went a bit heavier with a salad of Maine lobster with fennel and black trumpet mushrooms. Kyle drank less wine and more water. Doug was determined to polish off the first bottle and get to the second.
Bit of a shake-up is coming down, Doug said between bites. I'm sure you've heard.
Kyle nodded with a mouth full.
It's probably going to happen. 5 of our litigation partners are leaving with a bunch of associates and several clients. The mutiny is being led by Toby Rowland, and it's not pretty.
How many associates? Kyle asked.
26 as of this morning. It's a free-for-all. They're waving money and twisting arms, and no one knows how many will eventually leave, but it will knock a hole in litigation. We'll survive.
How do we fill the gap?
We'll probably raid another firm. They didn't teach you this in law school?
They both laughed and returned to their food for a moment. Will this increase the workload for those left behind? Kyle asked between bites.
Doug shrugged as if to say yes. Maybe. It's too early to tell. They're taking some big clients with some big lawsuits. In fact, that's why they're leaving.
Is Trilon leaving or staying?
Trilon is an old client, and it's firmly within the protective custody of Mr. Wilson Rush.
What do you know about Trilon? Doug was eyeing him closely, as if they were moving into territory that was off limits. Just what I've read in the newspapers and magazines. You ever worked for them?
Sure, several times.
Kyle decided to push on, just a little. A waiter removed their plates. Another poured more wine. What's this Barton dispute all about? The journal said the court file is locked away because the issues are so sensitive.
Military secrets. Huge sums of money involved. The Pentagon is all over it. They tried like hell to stop the companies from fighting, but it blew up anyway. There's a lot of technology involved, not to mention a few $100 billion.
Are you working on it?
No, I passed. It was quite a team, though.
Fresh bread arrived to cleanse the palate. The first bottle was empty, and Doug ordered a second. Kyle was carefully pacing himself.
The partners and associates who are leaving, Kyle said. How many are working on the Barton lawsuit?
I don't know. Why are you so interested?
Because I don't want to work on it.
Why not? Because I think Trilon is a rogue defense contractor with a rotten history of making cheap products, screwing the government and the taxpayers, dumping dirty weapons around the world, killing innocent people, promoting war, and propping up nasty little dictators, all in an effort to increase the bottom line and have something to show the shareholders.
Anything else?
Lots. You don't like Trilon?
No.
The company is an extremely valuable client.
Good. Let someone else work for them.
Associates are not allowed to choose who they work for.
I know. I'm just sharing my opinion.
Well, keep it to yourself, okay? That kind of language will get you a lousy reputation.
Don't worry. I'll do the work that's assigned to me.
But as a favor, as my supervising partner, I'm asking that you keep me busy elsewhere.
I'll see what I can do, but Mr. Rush makes the final decisions.
The second wine was a Pinot Noir from South Africa, and it too caused Doug's eyes to roll around. Their entrees, braised pork shoulder and aged prime rib of beef, were not far behind, and they got serious about eating.
You know your rate now goes to $400 an hour, Doug said, chewing.
Are you still at $800?
Yes.
Kyle was not sure he had the spine to bill a client, regardless of how large the corporation might be, $400 for an hour of his inexperienced legal work. Not that he had a choice.
On the subject of billing, Doug said, for the month of October, I need you to estimate my hours on the Ontario bank case. I got busy and lost track.
Kyle managed to keep chewing a small bite of braised pork, but he almost choked. Did he say, estimate my hours? He certainly did, and this was something new. There had been nothing at orientation, nothing in the handbook, nothing anywhere about estimating hours. Just the opposite. They had been trained to treat billing as the most important aspect of their practice. Pick up a file, look at the clock. Make a phone call, record the time. Sit through a meeting, count the minutes. Every hour had to be accounted for, and the billing was done on the spot. It was never to be delayed, and it had to be precise.
How does one estimate hours? Kyle asked carefully.
Look at the file, check the hours you billed on it, look at my work, then estimate my time for the month of October. It's no big deal.
At $800 an hour, it was indeed a big deal.
And don't underestimate, Doug said, swirling his wine in the goblet.
Of course not. If we're going to guess here, let's be damn sure we land on the high side.
Is this a common practice? Kyle asked.
Doug snorted in disbelief and swallowed a hunk of beef. Don't be stupid, boy. It happens all the time.
And since we're now talking about Ontario Bank, he said, meat visible between his teeth, bill him for this lunch.
I was planning on getting the check, Kyle said, a lame effort at humor.
Of course not. I'll put it on a credit card and bill the bank. I'm talking about our time. 2 hours for you, now at $400, and two for me. The bank had record earnings last year.
That was nice to hear.
They would need healthy earnings to continue their relationship with Scully and Pershing. $2,400 for lunch, and that did not include food, wine, or tip.
And now that you've passed the bar, Doug said as he took another bite, you are entitled to use the black cards and bill clients for dinner. The rule goes like this. If you work until 8 o'clock at night, then call a car. I'll give you the number and code and be sure the client gets billed for the car. And if you choose, you can go to a restaurant, spend no more than $100 on yourself, and also bill the client.
You gotta be kidding.
Why?
Because I'm at the office almost every night until 8. And if somebody else is buying dinner, then I'll be damned sure I stay until 8.
Attaboy.
Seems kinda rich, doesn't it?
What?
Billing the client for expensive dinners and lunches and cars?
A swirl of the Pinot,
a thoughtful stare at the red liquid, a long pull.
Kyle, my boy, look at it this way. Our biggest client is BXL, the seventh largest company in the world. Sales last year of $200 billion. Very smart businessmen who have a budget for everything. They live by budgets. They are fanatics about budgets. Last year, their budget for legal fees was 1% of their total sales, or about $2 billion. We didn't get all of that, because they use 20 different law firms around the world, but we got our share. Guess what happens if they don't spend the amount they budget, if their legal fees fall short? Their in-house lawyers monitor our billings, and if our numbers are low, they call up and raise hell. What are we, the lawyers, doing wrong? Aren't we properly protecting them? The point is, they expect to spend the money. If we don't take it, then it screws up their budgets. They get worried, and maybe they start looking around for another firm, one that will work harder at billing them. You follow? Yes, Kyle followed. It was beginning to make sense. Expensive meals were necessary not only to keep the hungry lawyers going, but also to properly balance their clients' financial statements. Now it seemed almost prudent. Yes, Kyle said, and for the first time the wine warmed his brain and made him relax. Doug spread his arms and looked around.
And look at where we are, Kyle. Wall Street. The absolute pinnacle of success in America. We're here. We're on top. We're smart and tough and talented, and we make a boatload of money to prove it.
We are entitled, Kyle. And don't forget it.
Our clients pay us because they need us, and we offer the best legal advice money can buy. Never forget that.
John McAvoy had lunch every day at the same table at an old cafe on Queen Street in York. And from the time Kyle was 10 years old and hanging around the office, he loved having lunch with his father. The cafe's special was a vegetable plate that varied each day and cost little, with homemade rolls and iced tea, no sugar. The cafe attracted lawyers, bankers, and judges, but there were also mechanics and bricklayers. The gossip roared, and the bantering was nonstop. The lawyers always joked, "Who's paying for lunch?" and boasted of wealthy clients who they'd stick with a $3.99 check. Kyle doubted that his father ever gave a passing thought to billing a client for lunch. Doug insisted on dessert. 2 hours after entering the restaurant, they pushed themselves out the door and into the black car. Both nodded off during the 15-minute ride back to the office. Chapter 25. For the first time in the 9-month life of the operation, Kyle contacted Benny and suggested they meet. All prior meetings had been prompted by the handler, not the asset. Kyle gave no reason for wanting to meet, but then none was necessary. It was assumed that Kyle finally had something valuable to pass along. It was almost 6 p.m. on Friday, and Kyle was working in the main library on the 39th floor. By email, Benny suggested the Hotel 60 Thompson in Soho, and Kyle agreed. Kyle always agreed because he was not allowed to disagree or suggest another meeting place. It didn't matter. He had no intention of showing up, not that Friday night. Joey wasn't in town yet. 4 hours later, Kyle was hiding in the Placid Mortgage tomb, mindlessly flipping through foreclosure files, now at $400 an hour, when he emailed Benny with the sad news that he wouldn't be leaving the office anytime soon. Could be an all-nighter. Although he loathed the work and hated the tomb and found it hard to believe he was still at the office so late on a Friday night, he was slightly amused at the image of Benny waiting impatiently in the hotel room for a meeting that would not take place because his asset was holed up in the office and wouldn't come out. The handler couldn't complain if the asset was hard at work. Kyle suggested a meeting late Saturday afternoon, and Benny took the bait. Within minutes, he emailed the instructions. 7 p.m., Saturday, room 42, Worcester Hotel in Soho. So far, a different hotel had been used for each meeting. On a desk phone, Kyle called Joey's new cell number and passed along the details. His flight from Pittsburgh would arrive at LaGuardia at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon. He would take a cab to the Mercer Hotel, check into his room, and kill time while his friend practiced law. He would roam the streets, walk in the front doors of bars and out the back, browse through bookstores, dart here and there in cabs, and when he was certain he was not being followed, he would drop in at the Worcester Hotel and mill around the lobby. He had in his pocket a copy of the Benny Wright composite Kyle had been perfecting for weeks. Joey had studied it for hours and was confident he could spot the man anywhere. Now Kyle wanted Benny in complete digital color. At 7:30, Kyle walked through the hotel lobby and took the elevator to the fourth floor. Benny had a small room, no suite this time. As Kyle tossed his trench coat and briefcase on the bed, he glanced into the bathroom.
"Just looking for Nigel, or perhaps another surprise," he said as he flipped on a light switch.
"Just me this time," Benny said.
He was relaxing in a velvet chair.
"You passed the bar. Congratulations."
"Thanks."
The inspection over, Kyle sat on the edge of the bed. The inspection had revealed no one but Benny, but it had also revealed no luggage, no shaving kit, nothing to indicate Benny would stay in the room after Kyle left.
"You're putting in the hours," Benny said, again making an attempt at small talk. "I'm a full-blown lawyer now, so evidently I'm expected to work even more."
He noted the shirt. Light blue cotton, no pattern, no buttons on the collar, no necktie. The slacks were dark brown, wool, pleated. The jacket was evidently in the closet next to the bathroom, and Kyle cursed himself for not noticing it. Dark socks, no distinguishable color. Black scuffed shoes, quite ugly. "Here's the scoop," Kyle said. 5 litigation partners are splitting off. Abraham, Devere, Hanrahan, Roland, and Bradley. They're opening up their own shop and stealing at least 3 clients in the process. As of last count, 26 associates are jumping with them. Of the partners, Bradley is the only one working on the Trilon Barton case. However, at least 7 of the associates are assigned to the lawsuit.
"I'm sure you have a memo."
Kyle pulled out a single sheet of paper, tri-folded, and handed it over. It was a summary of the names of all the Scully and Pershing lawyers who were leaving. He knew Benny would want it in writing, something to preserve in the file and keep as evidence of his treachery. There. He'd finally done it. He'd handed over firm secrets, and now there was no turning back. Except that it was not exactly accurate. The gossip was changing by the hour, and no one seemed to know precisely who was planning to leave. Kyle had taken a few liberties with the names, especially those of the associates. Nor was it highly confidential information that he was passing along. The New York lawyer, the Trade Daily, had carried at least 2 brief stories about the spin-off in the litigation section of Scully and Pershing. Given the ever-shifting nature of law firm personnel, it was not headline news. And besides, Benny already knew as much as Kyle. And Kyle knew he knew. The memo gave no details about the business of any client. In fact, it did not mention a client by name. While it appeared to have been put together in a hurry, Kyle had spent time on it and was convinced it was not a violation of ethics. Benny unfolded the sheet of paper and studied it carefully. Kyle watched him for a moment, then said, "I need to use the bathroom."
"In there," Benny said, pointing without looking.
As Kyle walked to the bathroom, he passed the closet, its door half open, and hanging on a rack was a cheap navy sport coat and a dark gray trench coat.
"I'm not sure this means anything," Kyle said when he returned. "Trilon's in-house attorneys are hands-on, and they prefer the more experienced associates. Those who are leaving will likely be replaced with 3rd and 4th year people. I'm still a long shot."
"Who'll take Bradley's place?"
"Not a clue. There are a lot of rumors."
"Have you met Sherry Abney?"
"Yes, we played softball together at the picnic in Central Park. We hit it off, but she's not in charge of which associates are assigned to the case. That decision rests with Mr. Wilson Rush."
"Patience, Kyle, patience. Good intelligence is based on long-term placement and relationships. You'll get there."
"I'm sure I will, especially if you keep picking off the associates ahead of me."
"How'd you get rid of McDougal? Plant the drugs in his apartment?"
"Come on, Kyle. The young man had a serious problem with cocaine."
"He didn't need your help."
"He's on the road to recovery."
"You asshole, he's on the road to prison."
"He was dealing coke, Kyle. A menace to society."
"What do you care about society?"
Kyle stood and began gathering his things.
"Gotta run. My old pal Joey Bernardo is in from Pittsburgh for the Jets game tomorrow."
"How nice," Benny said, getting to his feet.
He knew Joey's flight numbers, coming and going, and he knew their section and seat numbers for tomorrow's game. You remember Joey? The second one in your little video?
It's not my video, Kyle. I didn't take it. I just found it.
But you couldn't leave it alone, could you?
Later.
Kyle slammed the door behind him and hurried down the hallway.
He ran down four flights of stairs and entered the lobby not far from the elevators. He made eye contact with Joey, then went straight to the men's room around the corner. There were three urinals to the right. He straddled the center one, waited about 10 seconds, then was joined by Joey on the left. There was no one else in the men's room. Light blue shirt, no tie, navy sport coat, all under a dark gray trench coat. Black-rimmed reading glasses that come and go, probably will not be wearing them when he comes down. No sign of a briefcase, hat, umbrella, or anything else. He should be alone. He is not staying for the night, so I expect him to be down shortly. Good luck. Kyle pulled the flush handle, left the room, and left the hotel. Joey waited 2 minutes, then returned to the lobby, where he picked up his newspaper from a chair and sat down. His dark hair had been cut short the day before and was almost entirely gray. He wore fake eyeglasses with thick black frames. The camera, slightly larger than a disposable pen, but practically indistinguishable from one, was in the pocket of his brown corduroy jacket, next to a red pocket square. A hotel security agent in a smart black suit watched him closely, though his curiosity had more to do with the relative inactivity of the lobby than with any real suspicion. 30 minutes earlier, Joey had explained to the agent that he was waiting on a friend who was upstairs. Two clerks behind the reception desk went about their business with their heads down, seeing nothing but missing little. 10 minutes passed, then 15. Each time an elevator door opened, Joey tensed slightly. He kept the newspaper low, on his knees, so that he could appear to be reading while the camera had a clear shot at the target. A bell. The door to the elevator on the left opened, and Benny the handler was there all by himself in a long gray trench coat. The composite of his face was remarkably accurate. Slick bald head, a few strands of black hair greased down about the ears, long narrow nose, square jaw, heavy eyebrows over dark eyes. Joey swallowed hard, his head down, and squeezed the on button in his left hand. For 8 steps, Benny walked directly toward him, then veered with the marble walkway toward the front door and was gone. Joey twisted his upper body slightly so the camera could follow. Then he switched it off, breathed deeply, and became engrossed in his newspaper. He looked up each time the elevator opened, and after 10 long minutes stood and walked back to the men's room. After lingering for half an hour, he feigned frustration with his tardy friend upstairs and stomped out of the hotel. No one followed. Joey plunged into the Saturday night chaos of Lower Manhattan, strolling aimlessly with the thick foot traffic, window shopping, ducking into music stores and coffee shops. He was convinced he'd lost his tail 2 hours earlier, but he took no chances. He hurried around corners and cut through narrow streets. At a used bookshop he'd scoped out late in the afternoon, he locked himself in the tiny toilet and washed his hair with a cleansing rinse that took out much of the gray. What was left was covered with a black Steelers cap. He dropped the fake eyeglasses in the wastebasket. The video recorder was stuck deep in his right front pocket. Kyle waited nervously at the bar in the Gotham Bar and Grill on 12th Street. He sipped a glass of white wine and chatted occasionally with the bartender. Their reservation was for 9 p.m. The worst-case scenario, indeed the only way they could screw up the operation, was for Benny to recognize Joey and confront him in the lobby of the Worcester Hotel. It was a long shot, though. Benny knew Joey was in the city, but he would not recognize him in disguise, nor would he expect him to be anywhere near the hotel. Kyle was assuming that since it was Saturday night, and since he had done little, if anything, in 2 months to arouse suspicions, Benny would be traveling light with a skeleton crew on the streets. Joey arrived promptly at 9. His hair was almost natural. In fact, as he walked through the front door, Kyle could not see a hint of gray. He had somehow exchanged the well-used brown corduroy jacket for a more stylish black one. His smile told the story.
"Got him," he said as he took a stool and began looking for a drink.
"So?" Kyle said softly as he watched the door for anything suspicious.
"Double absolute on the rocks," Joey said to the bartender.
Then to Kyle, much lower, he said,
I think I nailed him. He waited 16 minutes, used the elevator, and I shot him for at least 5 seconds before he passed by me.
Did he look at you?
I don't know. I was reading the newspaper. No eye contact, remember? But he never slowed down.
No trouble recognizing him?
No. Your composite is terrific.
They drank for a few moments as Kyle continued to watch the front door and as much of the sidewalk as he could see without being obvious. The maitre d' fetched them and led them to a table in the rear of the restaurant. After the menus were presented, Joey handed over the camera.
When can we see it?
He asked. A few days. I'll use a computer at the office.
Don't email me the video,
Joey said. Don't worry. I'll make a copy and send it snail mail.
Now what?
Good work, pal. Now we enjoy a fine meal, with wine, as you'll notice.
Proud of you.
And tomorrow we watch the Steelers kill the Jets.
They clinked glasses and savored their triumph.
Benny yelled at the three operatives who'd lost Joey after his arrival in the city. They had first lost him late in the afternoon, not long after he had checked in at the Mercer and hit the streets. They'd found him in the village before dark, then lost him again. Now he was having dinner with Kyle at the Gotham Bar and Grill, but that was exactly where he was supposed to be. The operative swore he moved as if he knew he was being followed. He had deliberately tried to shake them.
And did a damned fine job, didn't he? Benny yelled.
2 straight football games, one in Pittsburgh, now one in New York. More email chatter between the two. Joey was the only friend from college Kyle was now regularly in touch with. The warning signs were there. Something was being planned. Benny decided to beef up surveillance on Mr. Joey Bernardo. They were also watching Baxter Tate and his remarkable transformation. Chapter 26. At 4:30 on Monday morning, Kyle hurried off the elevator, alone, on the 33rd floor, and walked to his cube. As usual, lights were on, doors were open, coffee was brewed, someone was working. Someone was always working, regardless of the day or hour. The receptionists, secretaries, and clerks weren't due until 9 o'clock, but then they only worked a 40-hour week. The partners averaged around 70. It was not unusual for an associate occasionally to hit 100.
Good morning, Mr. McAvoy.
It was Alfredo, one of the plainclothes security agents who roamed the hallways during the weird hours.
Good morning, Alfredo, Kyle said as he wadded his overcoat and tossed it in a corner next to his sleeping bag.
How about those Jets? Alfredo asked.
I'd rather not discuss it, Kyle shot back. 12 hours earlier, the Jets had drubbed the Steelers by 3 touchdowns in heavy rain.
Have a nice day,
Alfredo said happily as he walked away. His day obviously made better because his team had slaughtered the Steelers, and more important, he'd found a place to rub it in. New York sports fans, Kyle mumbled as he unlocked his drawer and pulled out his laptop. As he waited for it to power up, he glanced around to make sure he was alone. Dale refused to punch in before 6 o'clock. Tim Reynolds hated mornings and preferred to arrive around 8 o'clock and make up for it at midnight. Poor Tabor. The gunner had flunked the bar exam and had not been seen since. He'd called in sick last Friday, the day after the results were published, and evidently his sickness had continued throughout the weekend. But there was no time to worry about Tabor. He could take care of himself. Working quickly, Kyle slid the tiny T-clip from the video camera into an adapter, which he plugged into his laptop. He waited a few seconds, clicked twice, then froze as the image appeared. Benny in perfect color. Standing at the elevator door, waiting patiently for it to open completely, then walking forward, the steady, confident walk of a man with no fears, no hurries, 4 steps over the marble floor, then a long glance down at Joey, but no connection, 5 more steps and he disappeared from view. Screen blank. Rewind. Watch it again and again, slower and slower. After the 4th step, when Benny looked casually at Joey, Kyle stopped the action and studied Benny's face. The shot was clear. The best of the video. He clicked on print and quickly made 5 copies. He had his man, at least on tape. How about this little video, Benny? Guess you're not the only one who can play games with hidden cameras.
Kyle quickly fetched the copies from the printer beside Sandra's desk. All printing was supposed to be logged in and charged to a client, but no questions were asked by the secretary if a few pages were used for personal reasons. Kyle held the five copies and patted himself on the back. He stared at the face of his tormentor, his blackmailer, the rotten little son of a bitch who was currently in charge of his life. He thanked Joey for such a superb job. A master of disguise, too quick for the bloodhounds behind him, and a brilliant cameraman. There was a voice somewhere nearby, and Kyle put away his laptop, hid the T-clip, and walked up six flights to the main library on the 39th floor. There, lost among the stacked tiers, he added four of the prints to his hidden file. The fifth he would mail to Joey with a note of congratulations. From an upper-level balcony, he looked down at the central floor of the library. Rows of tables and study carrels, piles of books scattered around urgent projects. He counted eight associates hard at work, lost in a world of research for memos and briefs and motions that were past due. 5 o'clock on a Monday morning in early November. What a way to start the week. The next step in his scheme had not yet been determined. He wasn't certain there was a next step, but for the moment, Kyle was content to take a breath, savor a small victory, and tell himself there was a way out. Just minutes after the markets opened Monday, Joey was chatting with a client who wanted to dump some more oil stocks when his second desk phone rang. He routinely carried on more than one phone conversation at the same time, but when the second caller said, "Hey Joey, it's Baxter. How are you?" Joey got rid of the client.
"Where are you?" Joey asked.
Baxter had left Pittsburgh 3 years earlier, after they graduated from Duquesne, and he seldom returned. When he did, though, he rounded up the old gang, those who could not avoid him, and threw some wild, drunken party that killed a weekend. The longer he stayed in L.A. and pursued his acting career, the more insufferable he became when he was back home.
"Here, in Pittsburgh," he said. "Clean and sober for 160 days now."
"That's great, Baxter. Wonderful. I knew you were in rehab."
"Yes, Uncle Wally again. God bless him. You got time for a quick lunch? I need to talk to you about something."
They had never had lunch, not since college. Lunch was too civilized for Baxter. When he met friends, it was always at a bar with a long night ahead of them.
"Sure, what's up?"
"Nothing much. Just want to say hello. Grab a sandwich and meet me down at Point State Park. I'd like to sit outdoors and watch the boats."
"Sure, Baxter."
Since it was all so obviously planned, Joey was becoming suspicious.
"Noon okay?"
"See you then."
At noon, Baxter showed up with nothing to eat, nothing but a bottle of water. He was thinner and dressed in old dungarees, a faded navy sweater, and a pair of black combat boots, all selected from the second-hand shop above Brother Manny's shelter for the homeless. Long gone were the designer jeans, Armani jackets, and crocodile loafers. The old Baxter was history. They embraced and swapped insults, and found an empty bench near the point where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers merge. A large fountain spewed water behind them.
"You're not eating," Joey said.
"Not hungry. Go ahead."
Joey set aside his deli sandwich and studied the combat boots.
"You seen Kyle?"
Baxter asked, and they spent a few minutes catching up about Kyle, Alan Strock, and a few of the other fraternity brothers. When Baxter spoke, he did so softly and slowly, and he gazed across the rivers, as if his tongue were working but his mind were engaged elsewhere. When Joey spoke, Baxter listened but did not really hear.
"You seem detached," Joey said, blunt as ever.
"It's just weird being back, you know. Plus, it's so different now that I'm sober. I'm an alcoholic, Joey. A full-blown raging alcoholic. And now that I've stopped drinking and all that poison is out of my system, I look at things differently. I'm never going to drink again, Joey."
"If you say so."
"I'm no longer the Baxter Tate you once knew."
"Good for you, but the old Baxter wasn't such a bad guy."
"The old Baxter was a selfish, pompous, egotistical, drunken pig, and you know it."
"True."
"He would have been dead in 5 years."
An old barge inched along the river, and they watched it for a few minutes.
Joey slowly unwrapped his turkey on rye and began eating.
I'm working my way through recovery, Baxter announced quietly. Are you familiar with the process in Alcoholics Anonymous?
Sort of. I had an uncle who sobered up a few years ago and is still active in AA. It's a great program.
My counselor and pastor is an ex-con, known affectionately as Brother Manny. He found me in a bar in a Reno casino 6 hours after I left the rehab clinic.
Now that's the old Baxter.
Indeed. He's led me through the 12 steps recovery process. Under his direction, I've made a list of all the people I harmed along the way.
Talk about frightening. I had to sit at a table and think of all the people I've hurt because I was drunk.
And I'm on the list?
No, you didn't make it. Sorry.
Darn.
It's mainly family members. They're on my list, and I'd probably be on their lists if they ever got serious about life. Now that I've made the list, the next step is to make amends. That's even more frightening. Brother Manny beat his first wife before he went to prison. She divorced him, and years later when he sobered up, he tracked her down to say he was sorry. She had a scar above her lip, thanks to him. And when she finally agreed to meet with him, he begged for forgiveness. She kept pointing to the scar. She was crying, he was crying. Sounds horrible, doesn't it?
It does.
I assaulted a girl one time. She's on my list.
The turkey on rye froze halfway down the esophagus. Joey kept chewing, but the food wasn't moving.
You don't say.
Elaine Keenan. Remember her? She claimed we raped her at a party in our apartment.
How could I forget?
Do you ever think about her, Joey? She went to the police. Scared the hell out of us. We almost hired lawyers. I tried my best to forget about it, and I almost did. But now that I'm sober and my mind is clear, I'm remembering things better. We took advantage of that girl, Joey.
Joey placed the sandwich aside.
Maybe your memory is not as sharp as you think. What I remember is a wild girl who loved to party, loved to drink and snort coke, but what she loved the most was random sex. We did not take advantage of anyone. At least I did not. If you want to revise history, then go ahead, but don't include me.
She passed out. I went first, and while I was doing it, I realized she'd blacked out. Then I remember you walked up to the sofa and you said something like, "Is she awake?" Do you remember any of this, Joey?
No.
Portions of it were familiar, but Joey wasn't sure anymore. He'd worked so hard to forget the episode, then he'd been shocked back to reality when Kyle described the video.
She claimed she was raped. Maybe she was right.
No way, Baxter. Allow me to refresh your memory. You and I had sex with her the night before. Evidently, she liked it because on the night in question, we bumped into her again and she said, "Let's go." She consented before we got back to her apartment.
Another long pause as each tried to anticipate what was next.
You thinking about having a little chat with Elaine? Joey asked.
Maybe. I need to do something, Joey.
I don't feel right about what happened.
Come on, Baxter. We were all drunk out of our minds. The whole night was a blur.
Oh, the wonders of alcohol. We do things we don't remember. We hurt others because of our selfishness. And when we finally sober up, we are compelled to at least apologize.
Apologize? Let me tell you a quick story, Brother Baxter. I bumped into Elaine a few weeks ago. She lives in Scranton. I was passing through on business, saw her in a deli during lunch. I tried to be civil. She freaked out on me, called me a rapist. I suggested we get together a few hours later for a polite cup of coffee. She showed up with her lawyer, a real tough broad who thinks all men are scum. So let's say you go over to Scranton, find her, and tell her you're sorry because there's a good chance she was telling the truth after all, and you want to feel better about yourself because now you're sober and you have this desire to be a good little alcoholic. Know what'll happen, Baxter? Indictments, arrests, trials, lawsuits, prison, all of the above. And not just for you, Brother Baxter, but for some of your friends as well.
A brief gap as Joey caught his breath. He had Baxter on the ropes. Time to finish him off.
Her lawyer explained that the statute of limitations on rape is 12 years in Pennsylvania, so time has not expired. We got a long way to go.
You get near her with some half-baked, feel-good apology, and you'll find out what rape is all about when they lock you away.
Joey jumped to his feet, walked across the boardwalk, and spat at the Rivers. He returned to the bench, but didn't sit down. Baxter hadn't moved, but he was shaking his head.
She wanted the sex, Baxter, and we were happy to accommodate her. You're blowing this way out of proportion. I've got to talk to her. Hell no! You're not going near her until the four of us, me, you, Kyle, and Alan, have a long discussion. That'll be ugly, won't it?
I need to talk to Kyle. He has more sense than the rest of us.
Yes, he does, but he has a crushing workload, tremendous stress.
Joey tried to imagine such a meeting between the two. Kyle, thinking about the video, while Baxter and his amazing new memory confirmed the details. It would be a disaster.
I'll go to New York, Baxter said.
Don't do it.
Why not? I'd like to see Kyle.
Okay, but if you talk to Kyle, then talk to Alan, too. Everybody talks for a good long time before you go blundering into Scranton and screw up our lives. I'm telling you, Baxter, this girl is out for blood, and her lawyer has a nose for it.
Another long gap in the conversation. Joey finally sat down and thumped his pal on the knee. Just a couple of old frat brothers who still cared for each other.
You can't do this, Baxter,
Joey said with as much conviction as he could muster. At the moment, he was thinking about his own skin. How would he tell Blair, who was now 5 months pregnant?
Hey, babes, just got a phone call. Seems they want me downtown. Something about a rape charge. Could be serious. Might not be home for dinner. Someone said reporters are waiting. Catch it on Channel 4. Later. Hugs and kisses.
I'm not sure about what happened, Joey,
Baxter said, softly and slowly as ever.
But I know what I did was wrong.
My uncle, the alcoholic, when he went through AA, he made a list too. He had stolen a rifle from my father, and he saved his money until he could buy another one. Brought it to the house one night. Big surprise, big scene. But if I remember correctly, you, as the alcoholic working your way through the 12 steps process, cannot make amends if doing so will harm others. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Then there's your answer. If you approach her and beg forgiveness, she and her lawyer will go nuts and drag in me and probably Kyle and Alan as well. You can't do it, because it will harm us.
If you did nothing wrong, you have nothing to worry about. I'm confronting what I did, and what I did was wrong.
This is crazy, Baxter. Look, you're clean and sober and full of the gospel. Good for you. I'm very proud of you. The future looks great, yet you're willing to throw it all away and risk 20 years in prison? Come on! This is madness!
Then what should I do?
Get your ass back to Reno or somewhere far away and forget about this. Go live a great life out there. Just leave us alone.
Two policemen walked by, laughing, and Joey stared at the handcuffs on their belts.
You can't do this, Baxter, he said. Give it some time. Pray about it. Talk to your minister.
I have already.
And what did he say?
He said to be cautious.
Smart guy. Look, you're in a state of transition right now. Everything is unsettled. You're out of LA, you're clean and sober, all good stuff. Again, I'm proud of you. But it's a mistake to rush off and do something foolish.
Let's walk,
Baxter said, and slowly rose to his feet. They strolled along the river, saying little, watching the boats.
I really want to see Kyle,
Baxter finally said.
Chapter 27.
In the 4.5 months Kyle had lived in his grim little apartment, he had managed to avoid having guests. Dale had asked about it a few times, then let the matter drop. Kyle described his place as a dump with almost no furnishings, lukewarm water, bugs, and uninsulated walls. He claimed to be looking for something much nicer, but then what first-year associate had time to look for an apartment? The truth was that he wanted a dump for that very reason. He could keep guests away, and in doing so avoid the risks of having their conversations listened to and recorded. Though he had not attempted to rid the place of mics and electronic bugs, he knew they were there.
He suspected there were cameras, always watching. And since he had lulled them into believing that he was clueless about their surveillance, he went through the motions each day of living pretty much like a hermit. Intruders came and went, at least one per week, but there were no invited guests. Dale was content to meet at her place. She had a fear of bugs.
If you only knew, thought Kyle, my apartment has every kind of bug known to the covert world.
They eventually managed to sleep together without actually falling asleep beforehand. Both collapsed shortly afterward. They had violated firm policy on at least four occasions and had no plans to stop. When Baxter called and asked if he could crash at Kyle's for a few days, Kyle was ready with a string of lies that were mildly convincing. Joey had sent a mayday call from his desk phone to Kyle's just minutes after he'd said goodbye to Baxter.
"We gotta do something," Joey said over and over until Kyle told him to shut up.
The idea of Baxter lounging around his apartment and talking at length about the Elaine episode was almost too much to imagine. Kyle could see Benny with his technicians, clutching his headphones, listening to Baxter preach about the need to confront the past, admit everything, and so on. If the Elaine episode blew up back in Pittsburgh, Kyle would be dragged into it at some level, and Benny would risk losing his leverage in New York.
"Sorry, Bax," Kyle said happily on his cell phone. "I have only one bedroom, if you can call it that, and my cousin has been sleeping on the sofa for a month. She's in New York looking for a job, and, well, I gotta say, the place is cramped."
Baxter checked into the Soho Grand. They met for a late pizza at an all-night joint on Bleecker Street in the Village. Kyle picked the place because he'd been there before, and as always, had taken notes on its suitability for future use. One door in and out, large front windows that faced the sidewalk, lots of noise, and it was too small for one of the bloodhounds to enter without being noticed. Kyle arrived at 9:45, 15 minutes early so he could secure a booth and sit facing the door. He pretended to be engrossed in a thick document, the tireless associate ever dedicated to his work. Baxter was wearing the same dungarees, sweater, and combat boots Joey had described. They embraced, then fell into the booth talking nonstop. They ordered soft drinks, and Kyle said,
"I talked to Joey. Congrats on the rehab. You look great."
"Thanks. I've thought about you a lot in the past few months. You quit drinking during our sophomore year, right?"
"Right."
"I can't remember why."
"A counselor told me that the drinking would only get worse. I didn't have a serious problem, but one was definitely foreseeable, so I quit. Didn't touch a drop until a few weeks ago, when I had some wine. So far, so good. If I get worried, I'll quit again."
"I had 3 bleeding ulcers when they took me in. I thought about suicide, but I didn't really want to do it because I'd missed the vodka and cocaine. I was a mess."
They ordered a pizza and talked for a long time about the past. Primarily Baxter's. He unloaded story after story about the last 3 years in L.A., trying to break into the movie business, the parties, the drug scene, the gorgeous young girls from every small town in America doing everything physically possible to either get a break or marry rich. Kyle listened intently while keeping an eye on the front door and the front windows. Nothing. They talked about their old friends, Kyle's new job, Baxter's new life. After an hour, when the pizza was gone, they eventually got around to more pressing matters.
"I guess Joey told you about Elaine," Baxter said.
"Of course he did."
"It's a bad idea, Baxter. I understand the law, and you don't. You're walking into quicksand, and you could take us with you."
"But you did nothing. Why are you worried?"
"Here's a scenario," Kyle said, leaning closer, eager to unveil a narrative he'd thought about for hours. "You go see Elaine, looking for some type of redemption, forgiveness, whatever you think you might find there. You apologize to someone you once hurt. Maybe she turns the other cheek and accepts your apology, and you two have a nice hug and say goodbye. That probably will not happen. What is much more likely to happen is that she chooses not to take the Christian approach, doesn't give a rip about this cheek-turning business, and decides, with the advice of a pretty nasty lawyer, that what she really wants is justice. She wants vindication. She cried rape once and nobody listened. You, with the best intentions, will vindicate her with your awkward apology. She feels violated now, and she likes being the victim. Her lawyer starts to push, and things unravel quickly.
There's a prosecutor in Pittsburgh who, not surprisingly, likes to see his face on the front page. Like all prosecutors, he's tired of the mundane, the gang shootings, the daily street crime. Suddenly he has a chance to go after four white boys from Duquesne, and one just happens to be a Tate. Not only a great white defendant, but four of them. Talk about headlines, press conferences, interviews. He'll be the hero, and we'll be the criminals. Of course, we are entitled to a trial, but that's a year away, a year of absolutely terrifying hell. You can't do it, Baxter. You'll hurt too many people.
What if I offer her money? A deal with only two parties, me and her.
It might work. I'm sure she and her lawyer would enjoy those discussions. But offering money implies guilt, an admission of some sort. I don't know Elaine, and neither do you, but given Joey's encounter, it's safe to say she is not too stable. We can't predict how she will react. It's too risky.
I can't live with myself until I talk to her, Kyle. I feel like I harmed her in some way.
Got that. It sounds great in the AA handbook, but it's a different matter when other people are involved. You have to forget about this and put it behind you.
I'm not sure I can.
There's an element of selfishness here, Baxter. You want to do something that you think will make you feel better. Well, good for you. What about the rest of us? Your life will be more complete. Our lives could be ruined. You're dead wrong here. Leave this girl alone.
I can apologize to Elaine without admitting I committed a crime. I'll just say that I was wrong and want to apologize.
Her lawyer is not stupid, and her lawyer will be sitting there with a tape recorder, probably a video camera. Kyle took a sip of a diet soda and had a quick flashback to the first video. If Baxter saw it now, saw himself tag-teaming with Joey while Elaine was motionless, his guilt would crush him.
I have to do something!
No, you don't, Kyle said, raising his voice for the first time. He was surprised at the stubbornness across the table.
You don't have the right to ruin our lives. I'm not ruining your life, Kyle. You did nothing wrong. Is she awake?
Joey asks. The words rattle around the courtroom. The jurors scowl at the four defendants. Maybe they feel compassion for Kyle and Alan because there is no evidence that they violated the girl and find them not guilty. Maybe they're sick of the whole bunch and send them all to prison.
I'll take all the blame,
Baxter said. Why are you so determined to get yourself into more trouble than you can imagine? You're toying with prison here, Baxter. Wake up, man!
I'll take the blame,
he repeated, very much the martyr now.
You guys will walk.
You're not listening to me, Baxter. This is far more complicated than you realize. A shrug.
Maybe so.
Listen to me, damn it!
I'm listening to you, Kyle, but I'm also listening to the Lord.
Well, I can't compete.
And he's leading me to Elaine, to forgiveness. And I believe she will listen, and she will forgive, and she will forget.
He was firm and pious. And Kyle realized he had little else to throw at Baxter.
Let it sit for a month, Kyle said.
Don't do anything hasty. Joey, Alan, and I should have a say in the matter.
Let's go. I'm tired of sitting here.
They roamed the village for half an hour before Kyle, exhausted, finally said goodnight. He was dead to the world when his cell phone rang 3 hours later. It was Baxter.
I talked to Elaine,
he announced proudly.
Tracked her down, called her, woke her up, and we talked for a few minutes.
You idiot! Kyle blurted before he could stop himself.
It went pretty well, actually.
What did you say? Kyle was in the bathroom, splashing water on his face with one hand and holding his phone with the other.
Told her I've never felt right about what happened. I didn't admit to anything other than some misgivings.
Thank God for that. What did she say?
She thanked me for calling, then she cried and said no one has ever believed her. She still feels like she was raped. She's always known it was Joey and me, with you and Alan somewhere close by watching the action.
That's not true.
We're gonna meet in a couple of days, have lunch, just the two of us in Scranton.
Don't do it, Baxter. Please don't do it. You will regret it forever.
I know what I'm doing, Kyle. I've prayed about this for hours, and I'm trusting God to get me through it. She promised.